Welcome to the Atlantic Council Events Podcast. The Atlantic Council serves the global community by bringing together world leaders, foreign policy experts, and great thinkers to shape today's policy choices and navigate the global challenges of the 21st century. In the following program, General Philip Breedlove, former Commander U.S. European Command and Supreme Allied Commander Europe of NATO, offered his closing speech on Atlantic Council's public conference, The Future of NATO Enlargement and New Frontiers in European Security. Frederick Kemp, President and CEO of the Atlantic Council, moderated the discussion. The conference was held on June 8, 2016.
As Damon said, I'm Fred Kemp. It's good to be back up here again. Good afternoon. We're honored to have General Phil Breedlove with us to close out today's lively conference. And General Breedlove, I almost didn't recognize you there without the uniform on. But thank you so much for your service. You've just been and will continue to be in your retired life, I hope unretired, and will as you continue to work for our alliance and for the United States. Last month, you stepped down as Supreme Allied Commander of NATO and Commander of U.S. European Command after nearly 4 years at the helm and nearly four decades of distinguished military service. General Breedlove led U.S. Europe Command and NATO amid one of the most difficult security environments the transatlantic community has faced since the end of the Cold War. During his tenure, he oversaw NATO's transformation of its ISAF mission in Afghanistan, played a key role in implementing military reforms decided at the 2014 NATO-Wales Summit, and re-energized the alliance's ambitious military exercise program and spearheaded the alliance's refocus on Russia, which, of course, we'll get to. He was the recipient of the Atlantic Council's Distinguished Military Leadership Award, where he remarked on Russia's unfortunate shift from a relationship, quote, from one of strategic cooperation to one of strategic competition, and called upon the United States and its allies to demonstrate to Russia's Vladimir Putin that his policy wouldn't succeed, saying, again, quote, deterring Russia by carefully shaping Moscow's choices and managing Putin's confidence. In an age of uncertainty, General Breedlove provided certainty, reminding NATO's leaders and public and potential adversaries of the enduring value of the alliance. We've had a close and successful cooperation with you and also with your predecessors at NATO and European Command for many years, and we're eager to hear your insights. This is going to be Q&A. We started late, so we'll probably run until about 3:40, 3:45, just so you can manage your own time. I'll ask a couple of opening questions, but then really turn to all of you, because I know there's a lot of expertise and knowledge in the audience. So as you step down, what worries you most about the alliance, and what encourages you the most?
So before I even get to those two questions, you rarely get a chance like this beyond your change of command to say a couple of nice things about the men and women that you commanded. And so it's been almost a month, but I would just like to talk about all of the men and women of all 28 nations and our partners who I was fortunate enough to work with, work beside, and in many cases command. They were absolutely superb in some pretty tough times and are facing even more tough times now. So the first word to say is just thank you to all of the men and women and those that supported them that I was able to command over the years. Things that I'm happy about. We, I think, you've heard it said a couple of times on the stage already, have made some of the largest changes, not only structurally, but in the attitude of our alliance over the last several decades. Being a Cold War warrior myself, beginning in 1983 in my first service in Europe and sitting nuclear alert and working with the Army, et cetera, I understood what the Cold War was. And as the Cold War came to an end and we began out of our area operations in Afghanistan, the nature of our alliance changed. And military participation became more an option and a possibility than a commitment. And so we went through a couple of decades of very interesting development of military capability and power in NATO. And now we see that we're having to change that again. And I think that what we have seen is meaningful, but more importantly, actual change in the way we approach business in NATO. That's the encouraging part. The tough part, though, is to finish what we started. And in finishing what we've started, not close a door to whatever it is we're going to do with Russia in the future. I've heard several words already used on this stage to this point. Cooperation, partnership. You determine what that word is. At some point in the future, we're going to have some word with Russia. We're going to have to find that path. I believe item one in finding that path is to continue to finish the work that we started at Wales and to successfully implement those things that we are looking forward to as we go to Warsaw. And to do that convincingly, because as was said by many learned colleagues, Russia does understand power and strength and unity. And so those are good ingredients to beginning our path to, again, you choose the word, whatever it is that we're going to establish with Russia in the future.
Let me try out a word on you. Engagement. elements of containment, elements of engagement. But the question for me is, are we doing enough in containment? So you said, as you accepted our award, quote, deterring Russia by carefully shaping Moscow's choices and managing Putin's confidence. How's that going? And what do you read at the moment as Putin's intentions?
So how's it going? I think that Mr. Putin may actually be a bit surprised at how well NATO has moved forward with the changes that were started in Wales. And it's not perfect. I will take a challenge from anyone in the audience about, have we really accomplished everything that we set to in Wales as it relates to force structure changes, the way we organize, the new capabilities of decision making in SACUR and the NACIC, et cetera, et cetera. But I think that the progress is measurable and demonstrative in the way that we have exercised, and that the way that the alliance actually came together very quickly to do some things that many never thought it would do in building the VJTF and other things. So I think that Mr. Putin is probably at least understands that the alliance has moved forward in a way that probably was not expected by some. That, I think, he does understand that unity. We've always talked about his number one goal is really to crack either the EU or crack NATO. Because if he does that, then he gets everything else he wants. But what we have shown him since Wales is more unity. And it's not perfect. We've had a very good, engaging, sometimes lively conversation about the two strategic directions of NATO, East and South. But NATO has constructively met those challenges and continues today to try to make sure that both crowds their expectations are being met. So I think that we have some success. Now, clearly, and if you read over the past month or so, 2 months, as nations are going through their budget processes, you hear those words which challenge our abilities to do some of these things that we said we were going to do. Some of that, there is substance, and some of it, I think, is the politics of trying to get budgets adjusted and passed. But again, I think we need to keep focused on that unity so that we do present that very solid front to Mr. Putin.
I worry personally. Jim Hasek was nice enough to mention my book, Berlin 1961. But I think one of the points that it made was that because of the acquiescence to the construction of the Berlin Wall in 1961, Khrushchev took a message that he could go further and we face a Cuban Missile Crisis. There was a miscalculation, went too far. History doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme. I can't remember who said that. It's the final months of an Obama administration. If I'm Vladimir Putin, perhaps this is a time for me to get done what I still want to get done. What does he want to get done? And where would you watch right now, if sitting in your old position? What would you what would concern you the most to be watching right now?
Well, I think that that as I mentioned before, and I think that I wouldn't use I wouldn't even name this administration, but I would I would say that at the end of any administration and the beginning of any new administration, you have a period where I think many look at that as a time of opportunity. That could be opportunity from the side of the perceived aggressor. It could also be opportunity on our side because it presents the possibility of a more open dialogue, possibly. Mm-hmm. And frankly, I think that we need to go there. Mm-hmm. We need to begin to have meaningful dialogue. And the question is that dialogue possible by our government, or is that some sort of track two on steroids that begins these conversations? I don't know. But to get back to your real question, again, if Mr. Putin is able to break apart the EU or begin to make cracks and fissures in the EU or NATO, he gets everything else he wants. A starting point, I think, would be a full court press to try to break the sanctions, because that is then the first crack that becomes the fissure that becomes the problem. So I think you can expect pressure on things that would show disunity in either the EU or NATO. And there are those opportunities.
In that spirit, what constitutes success at the Warsaw Summit? And then go one step beyond that. What's not going to be done at the summit that you think one will have to turn attention to thereafter?
So I've said more than once about Wales. It was an incredible privilege to sit at the table at Wales with the 28 heads of state. And I was amazed at how fast that body came to the conclusion that the most important thing that came out of Wales was an early, strong, firm commitment to unity and Article 5 collective defense. In other words, right up front, we are together in this and we are serious about it. I think that's a really good starting point again for Warsaw. Early and very demonstratively to talk about the unity of our alliance in its endeavors. Second, as I said, one of the most important things, I think, and you asked me what I worried about, is that we finished the work we started. So we have almost completely structurally finished the work that Wales gave us. Multinational Corps Northeast, VJTF, NFIUs, all of the things that were structurally tasked to us, we've finished those and made them done. But we need to show sustainment in what we started so that there's there when our opponents look across the line. So a strong statement of commitment of the nations to meet those obligations that we set forth in making the changes that we expected at Wales. And then, as Evelyn and others mentioned before, and I don't want to speak for the alliance since I'm not in it anymore, but there are several next steps that are expected at Warsaw as it relates to deterrence and other things. And I think a firm commitment to a realistic program that we can expect to meet is very, very important.
Maybe you can be, as a military man, looking at the situation. We all know that there's language, persistent presence, operational, rotational, persistent presence. I mean, I know all the language, but what's the reality of what you have to do to deter in today's world and looking at Russian capabilities? And here I refer to the report of the RAND Corporation that noted that NATO can't successfully defend the territory of its most exposed members. So these new steps that are being taken, does that change that equation? And I suppose to get even more concrete, if you look at what the Russians are doing in the Kaliningrad Oblast, it seems as though NATO is facing a different environment in the region that may require looking at it quite differently. So I'm sorry to bundle so much in one question. But
yeah, and you actually asked two questions. You started first talking about deter, and then you went to defense.
Yeah.
And they're, as you know, they're not the same. And I think that we can deter. And I think that when it relates to Article 5 level issues in NATO soil, we have deterred. So we have been successful to this point. The defend part, David Ochmanek's work and others, is very good. But there are always, what comes out of that work is based on the model by which it is built and what goes into it. Mm-hmm. And what I always challenge in that work is the speed of decision making. Mm-hmm. And what I've said more than once is that we can defend if we get early, decisive movements from our nations and our NATO leadership. If we get in front of a problem, which requires good fused intelligence, indications and warnings, and the courage to take decisions based on those indications and warnings, I believe you can defend with early, firm decision making. So again, the models, I think the models are very good, but the premise under which the models are built, I think it's important to understand.
So let me ask one more question, then I'll go to the audience. You came to the Atlantic Council and exhorted us to do something that I'm not sure we actually really did, and I'm not sure NATO has actually really done, and that is to come up with a gray area strategy. And a lot of the people in our audience during the course of the day would say that the gray area strategy is bringing us all into NATO, but as that's not going to happen in the short term, Georgia, Ukraine, Belarus to a certain extent, Moldova for sure. Are we closer to having a strategy, or do they remain gray areas, and is this the volatile area that we have to look at in the next months, years?
My thinking crew tried for almost a year to get me to stop, and actually successfully, to get me to stop using the word gray areas because they didn't like the way that connotation played out. They wanted me to be more sharp and talk about nations between Russia and NATO, mm-hmm. which begs the question then of how do we describe nations that touch, NATO nations that touch Russia. But we do not have a gray area strategy, and I don't know if our government is expected to have a multitude of strategies. As you know, a lot of things we do, we wait until there's a problem and then we work it out. I think that by default, we may have set a strategy about these nations between Russia and Europe because we drew a very bright line at the NATO boundary, mm-hmm. didn't we?
Yep.
And so by setting a policy to the west of that bright line, we have sort of by default set a policy to the east of that red line. So I'm not sure that either you or our nation has succeeded at really articulating in a strategic way our approach to these nations. We all have, I think, understand the words, which I don't think are hollow, which are very true, that we have values and we expect to share those values. We expect that nations have self-determination and that we respect a nation's self-determination. And so there are policies that we expect in all these nations, but no.
Yeah.
Neither you nor our, we nor our nation has truly articulated a clear strategy, I think, for those nations.
So give Damon and our team a couple of weeks and we'll come up with it. Let's go to the audience. Questions, please. Yes. And for the microphone, the audience, please identify yourself, even though I know who you are.
Good afternoon, and General, thank you for all your service. We appreciate it. I'm Ariel Cohen. I'm a senior, non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. I just came back from Moscow, and they are talking themselves into a pre-war frenzy, in my evaluation, whether it's done for the purposes of regime survival or because of knee-jerk instincts that go back to Joseph Stalin, separate discussion. My question is this. Russia has a doctrine of escalation to tactical nukes quickly, and they also have a significant superiority in tactical nukes. Their response is they're stored, they're not deployed. To what extent do you see it as a real threat? And if, God forbid, we go to a shooting war by mistake, by accident, nobody wants the war on our side, clearly. How fast do you think they may be deploying and using TAC nukes?
So these are very hard questions, and I'll try to answer as best I can. Let me first say, though, to your first premise that they're talking themselves into a frenzy. That's why I brought up my very first comments, and I'll talk more about this in the smaller group tonight, as a matter of fact. And that is, I think that we have to, in a very determined way, not a casual way, we need to, in a very determined way, begin to establish quality communications with the Russians. If we wait for it to fall into our lap, we are going to fail, and this risks more problematic developments along those lines. You use several reasons why you think, I think it's all of those reasons. I think both of what you said, I think, are a part of why they are where they are. But I think the first and foremost point is that we have to, with purpose, with malice aforethought, if you'll allow me, set forth to establish a line of communications. And it may be frustrated and frustrating in the beginning, but I don't think, have any choice at this point. So we need to move out. And I'm not a military man, but I'll use those words every once in a while. So to the second point.
Is this accident at sea conversation a start in that direction, or is that?
It very much could be. Incidents at sea, which in UCOM we've established, we've grown to be both incidents at land, at air, and at sea. We have that line of communications. It has worked. Admiral Mark Ferguson, who was just relieved, had change of command a couple of days ago, had a very successful series of talks with the Russians just about a month before I left in our last INC-C conversations. It would be good to have a broader NATO INC, air, land, and sea, I think. This is a little bit more problematic because 28 nations want to be involved with how you focus these conversations, so it would not be an easy task. But I believe that mechanism would be a good one, and I've suggested it before I left. To the other point, the combination of escalate to de-escalate is the way we like to say it, and the fact that the Russians speak about, write about, and train to using tactical nukes as a logical and understood extension of conventional war is problematic. And how do you build a war plan that provides off-ramps or opportunities for de-acceleration so that you don't get to that point? Realizing that the whole reason they build that is to coerce you, to put you in a frame of mind that you have no other choice except for to capitulate or will end up in this ugly place. And so how do you build a war plan that responds to that line of logic that demonstrates power, demonstrates capability, but provides off-ramps so that both nations, but certainly the one that espouses using tactical nukes, sees an opportunity to in some way meet some of their objectives, but begin to decelerate or accelerate. That is an art, I think, and not a science. And it is one that many learned and well-trained officers and thinkers, civilians alike, in UCOM and other places are working through right now.
Questions? Please, in the back and then up here.
Yeah, hi, sir. James Drew from Aviation Week. I'm wondering, there's been a lot of discussion about who NATO would go to war for, whether it would be in America's interest to, say, send troops into battle for Georgia or some other new nation that, or some other smaller NATO member. How much of a challenge is it for NATO in your mind to be able to put its hand on its heart and say, we will defend you if you evoke Article 5, even though it may not be in the interest of the US, UK, France, or some of these larger members?
So again, you sort of mixed your question there. You were talking about, I think, partners and gray states, but then at the end of your sentence, you talked about smaller NATO members. You've mixed two ingredients that don't mix in the context of your question, I think. Rather than put words in the mouth of our government, I would just repeat what our president said at Wales. He was extremely clear that we will defend every inch of NATO territory. So I don't have any problems with that guidance. I completely understand that. And there was no questions about how that was stated. Now, your tougher question is the other part. And I am not a part of the government and will not offer any policy thoughts as to that. I will allow that for others to do there. And I've listened to the conversation today. It was rich. I'm not sure that I have anything as a person to add to that conversation.
Correct. Thank you, please.
Thank you, General. Iyame Urmisholi, I'm from The Voice of America. You mentioned that if Mr. Putin exploits the cracks, he will get everything he wants. What are those cracks, and would you call Georgia one of those?
I would never describe Georgia as a crack in NATO. So I don't mean to be flip in that reply. I would never describe Georgia as a crack in NATO. Remember, I was the military commander of NATO. Georgia was one of our most stalwart military forces. You know, 10 years ago, we chose the vice commander of ISAF based on numbers of troops contributed by a nation. In the last year of ISAF and the first year of Resolute Support, if we had chose the vice commander by that rule, the vice commander would have been a Georgian general. Georgia has exceeded the military requirements of NATO. Its troops are some of the best trained we have. They perform without caveat in every situation, every place we send them. They have died and bled alongside of us. I'm not going to remark to the political side, but Georgia is not a crack in NATO. Georgia is a stalwart, well-performing military member of our partnership.
Thank you. Please.
Thank you for being here, General. My name is Connor Clark. I'm an intern with the American Foreign Policy Council, and I wonder if you could speak to some of the strategic challenges with getting all the NATO members on the same page in presenting that united front, where it's clear that there already are some disagreements and there's no covering that up, whether it's the missile defense shield. There's internal disagreement, from what I understand, as to whether that really is directed at Iran or it could be a counter to Russia. Obviously, the Russians are viewing it that way, but there's even internal disagreement about NATO. There's issues with Turkey and the and their role in the refugees and how to handle that issue, especially vis-a-vis Russia, because of these ongoing potential terrorism concerns. You've seen President Hollande jetting off to Moscow for the weekend. You know, and how do you, if not on the political sense or diplomatic sense, but on the strategic front, what are some of the challenges and potential opportunities for resolving those more technical or military hardware or strategic issues of presenting a united front?
Again, please allow me not to sound flip, but you use the word disagreements. I think those are ongoing conversations. I'm just a Georgia boy, educated in Georgia. But I talk a lot about NATO, and what we do in NATO is making soup. And there's 28 flavors that go into the soup. And every time we build a soup and we come to a final consensus and we move forward, those ingredients are added in different levels and in different ways, and the soup tastes a little different every time it's made. But the bottom line is the soup is good and it's nourishing. And so we have a lot of conversations. Can you imagine how many people were there in your family? So how many times at your dinner table did the four of you disagree over something or have a conversation about something? And so multiply that by 7 and you get 28. And so I would just say that NATO is an alliance of 28 allies who all freely express their opinion as the soup is being made. But when the soup is made, we're pretty good at moving forward with 28 of us eating the soup. And so I take this much more positively than you. There are complaints, and let me tell you that General Phil Breedlove was one of the complainants at one time about the speed of decision-making in NATO. And frankly, in a couple of times and places, I was pretty glad that it was slow, because we might have gone somewhere we didn't need to go based on some good conversations. And then other times it was so fast I could barely keep up with them. When we launched the mission in the Aegean, I've never seen anything happen so fast. And we were working hard to get the military in put together to react at speed. So you used the word. I wouldn't use that word. I would talk about 28 allies who freely express themselves and then come together to make pretty good soup before it's all over.
It's really tempting to go after that metaphor, but I'm gonna restrain myself. I think I see one last question, and then I may ask something regarding soup as well.
No fun letting my old mentor give me a question.
General Breedlove, good to see you, sir, and welcome home. My understanding is right now there's an exercise, a NATO exercise, going on in Poland, and General Breedlove as the commander of the troops and the field commanders taking place, what do you tell them is the purpose of this exercise? In other words, why are we here?
General Schott, I would never presume to correct, but let me just do one small correction. It's not a NATO exercise. It is actually a Polish multinational exercise. There is a NATO exercise also happening in conjunction in another place. The alliance took a decision not to connect the two to make it less, hopefully, less offensive to the Russians. And so a decision was made to keep them separate. So the exercise Anaconda is a Polish multinational exercise. And we, the United States, are there in a very big way, a very big way. But it is, again, not a NATO exercise. Now, everybody in it is NATO or a NATO partner, and one could probably understand that the Russians don't see the difference in what's going on. But the political leadership of NATO took a decision to say this will not be under the rubric of NATO. It is a Polish multinational exercise. And then on the other side, there is a NATO exercise going on. So if you remember, sir, what we did when I first came aboard in NATO before Crimea, before Donbass, before they moved the line again in Georgia, et cetera, long before that, we were looking at what is the raison d'etre of NATO as ISAF ends? What is the glue now that holds NATO together as ISAF ends? And what we chose at that time was to recognize that we had been in a period of about 13 years of counterinsurgency operations. And we'd gotten pretty good at it. And our skills were high. But what had atrophied over that time was high-end Article 5 defense. We hadn't exercised at a divisional level, much less a corps level or a field army level. We hadn't done things that used to be part of our DNA in Europe, as you remember. And so we decided, again, before Crimea, before Donbass, etc., that we were going to set about rebuilding the Article 5 capabilities of NATO. And we set forward a series of exercises. Last year, Trident Juncture was built as this big exercise by some in the press as a big anti-NATO exercise. That exercise was completely built and designed before Crimea. It was executed just like we planned it before Crimea. So what I would say to the troops right now as they're exercising in Poland and other places is we have skills that we have lost over time. We need to be exercising both mentally in a command post way and on the ground, physically hooking radio nets and things that we have not done for many years at that echelons above brigade level, as you know. We need to do all of that. And so I would tell the troops that we are an Article 5 collective defense alliance. We need more practice at our basic skill set, and this is about that. I think that's the way, sir, I would approach that.
And then just my final question, and I know this could be an hour-long answer, but you probably don't want it to be, which is looking to the South. There's all sorts of debate now what one ought to be doing as you look at the South as NATO. What is the challenge that you think is most appropriate for NATO to take on?
So it's a multi-headed problem in the South. And we are already beginning to take on some of the problems in the South. And I think we need to get even better at that. So let's parse this just a little bit. The issue of flow of terrorist foreign fighters, criminality, and we have to acknowledge legitimate refugees that are coming across borders, coming across the water, etc. We have to address that. And I think that the nations are doing that. It's not perfect yet. There's more work to be done, but we are beginning to do that. We need to remember that we have an ally in Turkey that is being squeezed in a pretty tough place. To the south, a civil war. To the north, an increasingly hostile Black Sea. And so that is a critical and geopolitically incredibly important ally that we need to be focused on as an ally. I think we need to work with the EU to begin to address the problems that NATO is not designed to address in some of the issues along the northern coast of Africa, through the Levant and into Syria. As was said before, we are a political and military alliance. We are not an alliance that does well with judicial, policing, etc., etc. We are not an alliance that is built to address the humanitarian needs that are being created in those areas. And so I think there is opportunity to work with organizations like the EU, possibly the UN or others, to begin to add some of the skill sets that we have to help them in the heart of their matter as they begin to approach some of these issues. And then the alliance, I think, will, over time, begin to make decisions one way or the other. I judge neither way about whether they will be militarily more involved in some of these issues out of area.
Thank you very much. I don't know whether Damon wants to say any final words or exhortations. I do want to congratulate him and the incredible Atlantic Council team that's put this together. I want to thank you, General Breedlove, for 4 decades of service and 4 years of service to NATO. This is a rich conversation. We've been lucky to have you in the positions you've been in. We look forward to continuing to work with you on this set of issues. And thank you for really powerfully ending a very useful, timely day of conversations about Europe's frontiers and the future of enlargement. Thanks very much.
Thank you for listening to the Atlantic Council Events Podcast. For more information, please visit our website at atlanticcouncil.org and follow us on Twitter @AtlanticCouncil. The Atlantic Council, working together to secure the future.